This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Phaedra Boydaderis, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe. This is your weekly podcast about gamification, gaming technology, and play. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, not of any organization which we have been, are, or will be affiliated.
This is episode 133, Game Brains.
Hello, and welcome yet again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, who is very much alive as I'm recording this show. I won't say what's going to happen later.
It's always a good start.
But I'm here. I've got my sweet tea. I've got my good friend Michael Rowe, co-host here as well. So do we have a show for you? That's a rhetorical question.
Oh, darn. I was going to answer it. Because we do have a wonderful show.
We have a show about smartness and brains and cognition and all kinds of good stuff with the very first question: does playing video games make you smarter?
No. No, that's absolutely not true, or true, depending on what your perspective is, which could be right or wrong. This came to us from a tweet, if I remember.
Yeah.
From Girls Who Can Code,
yes,
I believe. And it's a really cool video about how games and gaming affects the development of certain parts of your brain. And I thought it was really cool because you know the brain game that you do where they put a word up on the screen and the word is in a color. And so they might write the word blue in yellow, and you're supposed to go read the word blue and go yellow. And then they write the word red in black, and you're supposed to read the word red and go black. Right? And they actually explain what those types of brain games do and what part of the brain they change or enhance. And one of the interesting things about the story is how people who play adventure games or first-person shooters tend to have the ability to track and concentrate on more individual things at once, or to deal with the complexity, the dissonance of seeing that word red and saying black. And they actually kind of go through the details of how that works and why it works. And I thought it was pretty cool. It's a really, really neat video in the typical style. The drawing style that was all the big rage a couple of years ago for marketing videos, right, where they have the little hand and a whiteboard pen drawing things out and erasing it and other stuff showing up. Kind of cool.
I liked it as well. And there's, like you said, a lot of perspectives on this. And it kind of does depend on the games that you're playing. And I think it also depends on what sort of outcomes you're seeking as you're playing these games. And do they make you smarter or not? Because some games are very much, you know, puzzle-oriented games. And they can put you in the right frame of mind to try to solve puzzles and problems. So there are some games that if you play them for a little bit and then you're off to try to solve a problem, you already are in the right mindset to look for patterns and look for problems and find solutions to them that maybe you couldn't have done in such a creative fashion beforehand. So,
yeah, and you know, have you played Luminosity?
I've not. I mean, I know about it and we've talked about it, but I've not played it.
Yeah, I tried it a couple of times, and while I could tell that I was improving the exercise that they were doing, I never understood why it was important.
Hmm.
Right? And this video actually does explain, like I said, it explains what each of those types of exercises is trying to do. And therefore, when would you do one exercise over the other? And like you're saying, problem-solving games and why you would do those right before you're doing a real problem to solve, because it, you know, fires those synapses in your brains.
Yeah. The trick is, just like with potato chips, you don't want to eat the whole bag of them.
What if it's a small bag?
A couple of chips are good, but you need to find a way to stop.
Bet you can't just eat one.
Yeah, exactly. So we had another article. This one was a TechCrunch article, also in via the Twitter, and that I think when I saw it first, I was like, oh, look, Google's using gamification. And I think I misread it, because it's actually Gmailify. It's not gamify. It's Gmailify. And this was a way that you can treat all of your Gmail and non-Gmail accounts as if they were Gmail.
Yeah, I read it the exact same way. Right? I was like, wow, they're gamifying mail.
It's like, oh, cool.
And why would they be gamifying mail with other accounts? And then I was like, oh, that's one of those, you know, game brain problems where you looked at the word and saw the wrong word.
Yeah. Visual dyslexia.
Yes. Which, but it's actually kind of interesting. You know, there's lots of different tools. Mailbox was one of them. Airmail is one that I'm playing with right now. Mm-hmm. That try to provide that unified inbox across all your different email accounts. On Android devices, the default mail client gives you some of that. On iPhone,
the default
one gives you some of that. But if you're really used to using one email client, like in this case, Gmail, wouldn't you like to have that feature or those features across all your other accounts that are not Gmail based? And that's literally what they're doing here.
Yeah, the way I read it was sort of the auto sorting that Gmail will do for you, right?
Yep.
Not likely something that I would do, because I think the way I've segmented my mail and where I get what I get, I'm able to use the native iOS mail.app, and it works perfectly.
Yeah, I've tried. Have you tried the Gmail?
I've never loaded up the Gmail app. I've not put in, what was the one, Swift, or, you know, all these other clients, you know, that were.
Yeah,
were
I tried there. It and I didn't like it. I actually don't like what they're doing. And what's really good for them on this, because in order to do the auto processing, they have to read the mail.
Right.
Now you've basically connected your other accounts like Yahoo, Hotmail, Outlook, etc.
Into Gmail
for them to get access to the mail in order to read the mail and do the classification. Right. So it's really a great learning thing for their systems. And I know we talked about, I don't know if it was on the show, but we talked recently about Google's Go playing computer, right? The algorithms that they're doing with, I think it's called DeepMind, to play Go. And how that is different than, say, the way Watson played Jeopardy, right? It's different attacks onto the same space of how do you learn and how do you do computer learning,
right.
And cognitive processing. And so having that amount of additional data that they don't have access to today actually can help them in those spaces.
Yeah, exactly. It provides additional vectors for advertising and for understanding what's going on. And if you're thinking about the Google Now platform, which a lot of people really like, you know, this is a way to say, oh, you know, I now have the other meeting invites or the other train ticket reservations or whatever I have now showing up in my unified Google Now experience. Which,
yeah, because if you think about it, you might use Gmail for your personal account and Outlook for your work account.
Right. So this has got to be an interesting security platform sort of thing here, too, that you would want to be thinking about if you do it. So being very serious just for a moment, which we hardly ever do, there is a business of play, which is very serious. And this article from TechCrunch is talking about what are the kinds of things that we should be expecting about where the next set of toys, whether they're robots or connected toys or whatever, is going to start coming out. So the business of toys will and has been ever more growing in terms of its sophistication, its cognition, its learning ability. And the article is asserting that the next big thing is going to look like a toy to start with. So what do you think about that idea, Michael?
Well, I think we see that today already, right? I mean, if you think about, and I'll just pick on something that I'm play with, right? 3D printing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That started off either deep in the labs as a very serious thing or kind of a home play thing for building little knickknacks and playing around with stuff.
And there's a new one from Mattel, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Matter of fact, I was watching a video on it yesterday, and do you remember, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the toy, but there used to be a Mattel toy where you would put this goop into a tray and then it would cook it.
Yeah, well, there was an Easy Bake Oven. Right?
Nope. Not Easy Bake.
There is a version of
Creature Maker
for boys. Yeah, Creature Maker, Creepy Crawly kind of thing.
Creepy Crawlers or something like that. Yeah,
it was, you would put this gelatinous mass.
Goop.
You would put that into this environment. I guess it probably used the same sort of light bulb technology to heat it up, solidify it a little bit, and give you a little jiggly thing.
And the review that I was seeing on the Mattel 3D printer was they're recreating it.
Ah.
Right? Because it's not a high-end 3D printer. It's not even, you know, a medium-end 3D printer.
Yeah, but it's still $300, you know. So as toys go and as a father
It's expensive as a toy, it's really on the low-end price tag of a 3D printer.
Right. And my feeling is that there will be and there can be lower cost versions of that too that will find themselves hacked into something even more interesting.
But to get to the point, right? I mean, this is the idea, right? There's these things that are coming in as toys.
Yes.
That are really the entry point for pretty advanced innovation. So look at the Sphero, right? Mm-hmm. Sphero was a toy. They used it for practical effects in The Force Awakens, right?
Yep.
BB-8 is a Sphero.
Yes.
But now when you think about from a robotics perspective, changing from trying to have a bipedal robot or a wheel-based robot into one that has a self-righting, because it's always right, motion or locomotion method for a robot could very well be the natural translation from toy to business.
Yes. Yes. But we've got plenty of other robotics examples and AI similar examples. I mean, do you remember the Teddy Ruxpin bear?
Yeah, that was creepy.
It was creepy. Well, I mean, it was in the uncanny valley for sure, wasn't it? It's like horror movie waiting to happen. But we've had a lot of these things for a long time. So the article is using to substantiate its concepts is that the amount of funding that is going into connected toys on a yearly basis has been steadily rising. We've been seeing that connected toys are attracting more attention just in terms of searches, and the robotic toys are going up as well, right? So and maybe the biggest jump of them all, where was the one here? There was one that was really big. The biggest one was venture funding in educational toys.
Yep.
So 2014, it was, what was it, 34.4? What's the figure? Is it millions?
Yeah, it's a really bad color combination.
Yeah, it's not a great one. But it jumps up to 88. So it's a huge, you know, jump across to get you where you're going. Oh, and now, you know, speaking of toys, I know we didn't have this in the show notes, but I do have to mention it.
But we will put them in the show notes.
It was just so funny. Well, the pre-show, right? You know, kind of get things ready. The new, which is not really new, it's kind of old, Monopoly game where you can play it as a cashless game. And did we put that in the pre-show? I don't think we did.
We didn't.
But I think I had it somewhere around here, or you did too. It was such a hoot to read the comments. And I think I'll leave it at that, because some of those comments probably are probably not really safe for work. But they were so funny. And just to put the little context around it, many people who play the game of Monopoly, not including the two of us, I'm sure, find a lot of joy in the game of being the banker or being sitting next to the banker and having sticky fingers to augment their cash hoard. And
nope, never did that.
I never did that either, right? You know, anytime I was the banker, I was always really good and made sure I was very accurate. And actually, the version of Monopoly that I played the most as a kid was the German version of Monopoly with Deutschmarks.
Yeah, I remember I played that one too.
Yeah. I mean, the American one was like, you know, I had $5 bills and $1 bills. It's like, what?
That's not enough.
That wasn't nearly enough.
10,000 Deutschmarks.
It was 10,000 Deutschmarks, and you know, I think the smallest was a 20, wasn't it? Or 100? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was definitely a different level of inflation between the two.
Yeah. So the article and some of the comments around it were like, you know, for the people who board flip that particular game, having everything that's tied into the little ATM in the middle doesn't make an awful lot of sense. So that was a lot of fun. All right. So moving from serious play to some serious automotive activity, one of the BBC news articles that I saw today, and you picked up on pretty quickly too, was Volvo having a keyless car app. And yes, the idea with this is that you can deliver a key to someone's smartphone. So having an app on your smartphone where you can deliver a key, you can share that key. So like if I needed you to drive my car somewhere, I could grant you a key, essentially access to my car temporarily over time that would expire and disappear. Or if you were a car rental company, you could do the same kind of thing, which is how they're prototyping this out in Sweden. I found this to be very, very intriguing on lots of different levels. And I was glad to note that Volvo was still going to be providing physical keys to their customers if they still wanted them.
Yeah, this one, seeing it for me was a nice trip down memory lane a couple of years ago when I was working in the auto space for IBM's fledgling IoT group. I mean, this was one of the exact use cases that we were showing at our conferences. I actually got to work on and write the demo app that we had that would trigger the messages from an iPhone app to a quote-unquote car, which was a Raspberry Pi sitting inside of a little Lego car that would do the lock and unlock, etc. And we talked about those exact use cases. So using it in a fleet system, tying all your driving preferences to the app so that when you went from one car to the next, and like in a rental situation,
radio station
would automatically set up the radio, the seats would be set in the right place, et cetera. The ability to take that as a token and give somebody else periodic restricted access to maybe just unlock your car but not drive it, or they could drive it over the next 2 hours. After that, the key becomes inactive, and as soon as you stop it, it's going to stop.
Yeah, and my thinking about transportation as a service and that sort of thing,
yep,
it becomes super interesting. So for
Car2Go, as an example, is a Mercedes company, right? That does this exact thing.
Yeah, and Zipcar, and there's a number of other ones that are similar to that. And the use case that was striking me about this was you could buy a car for an hour.
Yep.
And after that hour, the car is not available, and if you want another hour, you can pay for another hour, and then your key and the car will work again.
Well, what's really cool is now with self-driving cars, you could buy it for an hour, and then it opens the door, kicks you out, and drives home.
It pulls gently over to the side of the road and says, if you'd like to continue this drive, please insert additional currency. So, thinking about self-driving cars, I saw this tweet and a picture from Cory Doctorow at the Oakland airport, which had a sign that said smartphone app riders, you know, kind of like, you know, congregate here, which I'm sure is more for the Lyft and the Uber kinds of people for that particular airport. But I could imagine a time in the not too distant future where you might have the driverless car, you know, summoning spot. And that's where they would come pick you up and take you wherever you have to go.
Yeah, at CES this year, what they had is there was a default limo pickup area and a default bus pickup area to take you between the different sites of CES. And then like a block and a half away from the main convention area, there was the Uber / Lyft pickup error. So you had to go walk over there if you wanted to actually get a car that would pick you up in a timely manner.
Did you also have a tandem bike area? Hoverboard area, perhaps?
Yeah. That was it, the hoverboard area. But the problem with that one was the batteries kept exploding and they had to move it.
Bump, bump, bump. So you had found... I think one other thing that we wanted to touch on here briefly, which was the gamification market.
Yeah, this one was really, it's more of an FYI, but, you know, I'm on a mailing list for all kinds of different crap. And I mean that in a nice way. and after seeing the serious business of play and kind of the market descriptions there and how it's important, then I got a PR notification on the global gamification market worth $11.10 billion by 2020. And I would think part of that is the $4,600 that they want for the report. but if you need analyst type data, this is that's what it costs, right? We're kind of making fun of the cost, but that's really what it is. It's not cheap. But these reports really talk about, you know, forecasting, breaking out key vendors, what are they doing, what's the market size, the growth rates, et cetera. It might be a really interesting report, and, you know, our co-host Phaedra would probably be very much interested in this one.
I think she might be. And, you know, Michael, if you wanted to go someplace for cutting-edge analysis, leading thinking, talking about gamification, technology, integration with automotive, social, mobile, all these kinds of things, where would you go?
Well, I would go to gamesatwork.biz. Matter of fact, I would even rate them on iTunes, because every rating on iTunes of a 5-star rating makes it so that we get more information from our listeners and can expand the value of the show for you.
And if you are interested, you can even listen to us on your Roku or Apple TV if you so desire.
You could.
I have actually on my Apple TV. Yeah.
Yeah. Did the logo look really nice on that big screen?
It's really pretty big.
Very nice.
Well, team,
I hope you didn't subject the rest of your family to it, though.
Well, we had watched a movie the night before, so the TV was set on, you know, movie loud. So let's just say that our opening music theme was rocking.
All right. And that's to our, you know, our good friends over at Random Abstractions, who gave us that music.
Yep. Do appreciate it. All right. Well, with that, let's wrap this one up with a bow. And no. We have one thing we do before we wrap it up.
Yes,
Michael,
yes.
What games are you playing?
So as you know, I have an Apple Watch. I believe you have an Apple Watch, too.
I haven't lost it yet.
This week, I found the new app to play. It's called A Tiny Game of Pong. And it's Pong. It's the original game that got me hooked on computer games. You launch the app. It runs. You don't need to have your phone near you. It launches. It's completely standalone. It uses the crown to move the little paddle back and forth. You actually can, if it's free, but if you pay, you can do two-player. So I could compete against you.
Bluetooth or something, or what?
Yeah, something like that.
Ooh, cool.
And so I thought that was kind of cool. And it's Pong, man. It's Pong.
Yeah, I mean, what more can you ask about other than Pong, right?
Yeah.
So
what are you playing?
I've been playing this this little game on my phone, not the watch. It's called Tomb of the Mask. And the way this works is you are this character, and you can get these various masks to power things up. You go and collect coins and stuff. And it's sort of like a reverse gravity thing. So you swipe left, swipe right, swipe up, down. And you go zooming along these corridors in these tombs. And while you're going along the corridors, the water level is rising up from the bottom. So you are trying to stay away from the water. And then there are all kinds of other hazards like bats and arrows and slings and outrageous fortune.
Sounds a lot like the, what was it called? Pac-Man 256, which as you're, I mean, it's one of these infinite scrollers, and as you're moving, the bottom slowly gets ripped up behind you, so you have to keep going up the screen.
Yeah.
And the ghosts are different, and you pick up these different power-ups, like little lasers to shoot them out of the way, freeze mode, etc.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
In case you haven't played that one yet.
I haven't. What kind of got me moved in this direction was I opened up my old game of Rogue for iOS. So I was playing a little Rogue on iOS 2, and that's extremely unsatisfying because you always die so fast. Like, you run out of food, and searching is difficult to do to find the secret doors to get you to the next set of stairs, and those darn kestrels just come get you. All right, cool. So with that, I think now it's time to wrap. Yes?
You got it. Absolutely. All right.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Drop us a line, tweet, Facebook, something. We're eager to hear your ideas, things you'd like to hear us talk about here at gamesatwork.biz.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.